Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Monday, the 16th of May. We start a whole new week and some great shows coming up this week, starting with today, actually. Matt Bai of the New York Times, Brett Stevens of the Wall Street Journal will be joining us for our All Things Political segment. We have a lot to talk about. Matt's written quite a bit about the Republican presidential field and has a very interesting piece that he wrote just in the last couple days on Newt Gingrich. We'll be looking at that. We'll talk about immigration reform. The Times had an interesting piece yesterday on comparisons in chief. How enlightening is it to explain President Obama through his predecessors? I don't know if it is or not, but we'll do just that. Later on in the week, Dick Van Dyke is going to join us tomorrow. He has a new book, My Lucky Life in and Out of Show Business, an enormously talented guy. He'll be joining us tomorrow. And some of you have probably already had a chance to start the book about President Obama's mother. It is titled The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother by Janie Scott, who spent many years as a reporter for the New York Times. She will be with us on Thursday of this week. So just a few things to look forward to and lots in between to look forward to as well. We'll be welcoming phone calls for all things political, as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. Matt Bai is our first guest, writes the Political Times column for the New York Times and is chief political correspondent for the Times Magazine. He covered the 2004 and 2008 presidential campaigns. He is the winner of New York Times Notable Book for 2007. He is the author of The Argument, Inside the Battle to Remake Democratic Politics. Also, a 2004 profile of John Kerry titled Kerry's Undeclared War. He is currently at work on a new book about the failed era of boomer politics. He was a correspondent for the Newsweek, national correspondent before joining the Times, and before that, a city desk reporter for the Boston Globe. He was a fellow at Harvard's Institute of Politics at the Kennedy School of Government, where he led a seminar on the next generation of political journalism. Matt, thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, Kathleen, that's the long version, huh?
Well, it wasn't even the long version. It was the medium version, I would say.
It's the medium version. I want to hear a Dick Van Dyke talk. Maybe I'll find a way to tune back in tomorrow.
Yeah, he'll be on tomorrow. I'm looking forward to talking. He's a talented guy, isn't he?
Dick Van Dyke. I hadn't thought about him. I didn't realize he had a book coming out, but I mean, we all grew up watching Dick Van Dyke, even in reruns. I grew up watching him in the reruns, but we all watched Dick Van Dyke.
And he evidently has had a really happy life because the subtitle is My Lucky Life in and Out of Show Business. So it's going to be an uplifting interview.
Book.
Right, exactly. Well, he'll be on tomorrow at 10 o'clock, just for your knowledge. Well, let's start with Newt Gingrich, who's an interesting guy. And I'm wondering, you say in your piece, well, you say a lot about him, that people think of him, he does have this reputation as a substantive thinker. Is he a substantive thinker?
He is a substantive thinker. And I got to tell you, Kathleen, there is no, and, you know, we're going to, if you're going to take calls in the show, you're going to find out there's probably no Republican politician who instantly evokes the kind of emotional fury on the left and among a lot of my readers as Newt Gingrich does. And when you credit him for being a substantive or historical thinker, you invite all kinds of fury in your direction, which this column, as other things I've written, generated. And, you know, I think it's because there is so much intellectualism and academic orientation on the left, and Gingrich is viewed as someone who's almost an imposter, who holds himself out as an intellectual and an academic and a historian, but is in fact not of the same caliber and or the same integrity as the people the left admires. I don't think that's really fair. I mean, look, the man, if you spend a lot of time with him, he is an avid historian. He's extremely well read. He's extremely knowledgeable. He connects a lot of dots. He retains and can integrate a ton of information, much in the way that someone like a Bill Clinton can. I mean, he has a pretty both a very informed and a very subtle mind. You know, the thing about Gingrich And I think the thing about a lot of people, frankly, who wield historical fact these days on all sides of the ideological spectrum, is that he tends to marshal those facts in the pursuit and support of positions that can be somewhat extreme and that are sort of preset. So he's not actually out there looking to history to discover the answer. He's actually looking to make an argument using his knowledge of history as a battering ram. And for that reason, you do have to be very careful about simply taking his version of events and running with them.
Who are his heroes politically?
Well, you know, it's interesting. His heroes, I mean, he has many. And, of course, you know, he would tell you, I'm sure they'll ask him that question, and his first answer, like all Republicans, is going to be Ronald Reagan,
right,
which is so ubiquitous now that at the last debate when they were electing a Republican chairman, the moderator said, I don't know if it was Tucker Carlson or somebody, I'm forgetting, but the moderator said, you know, besides Ronald Reagan, who's your hero? Because they didn't want to hear the same answer over and over. But interestingly, you know, Gingrich sees himself as a really consequential player in American history, and so he empathizes and thinks about and idolizes an array of people like Charles de Gaulle in France, like Winston Churchill, like Reagan. And the thing that they tend to have in common, the reason he's drawn to these great sort of statesman-like figures, is that they lost before they won. They lost power, in some cases were disgraced, really, sort of humiliated, and then came back to lead, and this is something he calls the theory of departure and return, as he studied it in history. And I think it's important to Speaker Gingrich because he sees himself as someone like that, who's following a similar trajectory to these figures, and that's why he believes this moment to be portentous for him. And I think that's why he's running for president, because he has always believed that there's another turn of greatness in him and in his career.
Ronald Reagan was divorced, and we all got past that. Newt Gingrich has a pretty messy past when it comes to his relationships, and I think, I could be wrong about this, but I think a lot of people have a perception that he wasn't very kind to one of his wives, who he left when she was very sick. Does that really stand in his way? Because we do remember that about Newt Gingrich.
I don't know how it stands in his way. I mean, there's two separate questions here. One is the one you posed. Does it stand in his way with Republican voters, which I think is the right question? And then there's this question of, you know, how much should we all be focused on it? Because I got a ton of mail this week. And in fact, I was on with Meet the Press with Gingrich yesterday, and I'll get a ton more mail today saying, you know, why aren't you focusing more on his personal hypocrisy? So, you know, with the voters, I just don't know the answer to that. It's a long time past. He's apologized quite sincerely and profusely, it seems. He's converted to Catholicism, which he will stress with some of the religious conservatives in his party. How much people care generally now about personal transgressions, how much social conservatives who do care will forgive him because of the time period that's passed and because they've now had experience with a bunch of candidates with some messy personal lives, I don't know the answer to that. My guess is it matters some, but not nearly as much as it would have, you know, 10 years ago. In terms of, you know, what we look at as journalists, I'm uncomfortable sort of delving into people's personal and sex lives, not because I think it's always off limits or always irrelevant, but because we often make it more relevant than it is simply because people care, and because I think it's a very incomplete and often irrelevant measure of a person's fitness to lead and character as a political leader. There are a lot of things that historically have gone into this idea of character, and in the last 20 or 25 years, we've pretty much relegated it entirely to a person's personal behavior. So, you know, Gingrich's behavior, I think, was quite relevant in the sense that it did open him to charges, serious charges of hypocrisy, where he prosecuted the impeachment of Bill Clinton. But I also think it's been a long time now. He's apologized. A lot has changed in the country, and I don't think it's especially relevant for people trying to write about the dynamics of the campaign.
You do, though, single out the younger generation of voters in saying that he turns, which is hard to believe, 68 next month, which would make him a hard sell for a younger generation of voters who remember him as the guy who helped impeach Bill Clinton.
Yeah, I think it does, and I think this is an underrated obstacle for Newt Gingrich, because if you look at the top tier of candidates as they appear to be shaping up now, and I don't necessarily put him in the top tier, I'd say he's probably on the bubble of being in the top tier. But if you look at the former governors who are now emerging, and that would be Mitt Romney, a Tim Pawlenty, possibly a John Huntsman, possibly Mitch Daniels, they're all younger. Here we have Gingrich, who, you know, is basically the same age Reagan was when he ran, and whose political identity was forged in a different era. And I think there is probably a sense that Republicans need to turn that generational corner in the way that Democrats did with President Obama in order to be competitive. I think a lot of Republicans will look back to 1996 and remember that Bob Dole really never seemed to have a chance, largely because he seemed, as admirable as he was to a lot of voters, to be a step backward, whereas Bill Clinton had moved the country generationally forward. Now, you know, there's potential differences here. I mean, one is, you know, Peggy Noonan made the point yesterday on Meet the Press that that Speaker Gingrich is new to a lot of younger voters. They don't remember him at all, and so he might seem like a fresher face than we in Washington think he is, which seems far-fetched to me, but is possible. You also have to, I think, give new credit for being a guy who's really embraced the new technologies and sort of the ethos of the moment. He's always been a futurist. He's got a million plus followers on Twitter or Facebook. I mean, he is a multi-platform, multimedia, high-tech candidate in a way that a lot of these guys are not. And perhaps that does go some way toward mitigating the age factor.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about what's happened in the last couple of weeks in terms of, can any of these people beat a president who seems to be newly admired by so many people? We have put to rest the birther controversy because of the capture of Osama bin Laden. The economy seems to be doing a little bit better, but not a whole lot better. Is he at all vulnerable at this point? Could any of these people you've mentioned beat him?
Sure. I mean, let's stipulate a couple of things. One, that all incumbent presidents in the modern era are beatable. I was talking about this with somebody. I mean, I think the last incumbent president who was maybe unbeatable was Ronald Reagan in 1984. Although, if you talk to Gary Hart, who lost the primary that year, he'll tell you he still thinks he could have beaten Ronald Reagan in 1984. Incumbents are beatable. And in a general election, I think you're basically flipping a coin in some sense. Anybody who gets a nomination has a shot at winning a general election based on a lot of factors they don't control. And you have economic factors that, if they stay in the ballpark of where they are now, would historically be very, very damaging for an incumbent president. And also, I think you have to grant that while President Obama is riding this wave after the killing of Osama bin Laden, that's not likely to last till election day. It enhances his stature as a commander-in-chief, I think, permanently, but doesn't necessarily alter the dynamic of the race. What does matter, I think, a lot more than that in the favor of the president are these likability ratings that continue to be, these favorability ratings that continue to be very, very resilient no matter what happens in the economy. Now, I'm not talking about job performance, because those go up and down, and often he's been under 50 and people don't think he's doing a great job and they don't like his handling of the economy, etc. But almost invariably since he took office, more than half of the American public wishes this man well. They like him. They like who he is. They believe he means well. They believe he's honest. This is not a ticket to reelection. People believe Jimmy Carter was real honest and moral, too, and they loved him as a grandparent, just not as somebody you wanted in charge of your country. But I do think it's a very strong underpinning for an incumbent president to build on, and I think it's probably the strongest asset President Obama has and the thing that makes him less vulnerable than he otherwise might be.
And tell me if you see, as I appear to, a pretty deep philosophical difference among all of the Republicans. We've got those who are concerned about public employee unions. We've got a lot of people who are public workers who are upset with governors like Daniels and Walker and Christie. They seem to share a certain kind of philosophy, whereas some of the others have very different philosophies. Is somebody embracing a conservative anti-public worker agenda here? Are more Republicans going that direction, or are they going another direction? What's the direction?
I don't think we know yet. I mean, the two Republican leaders in putting this argument forward, I think, on the state level have been Chris Christie in New Jersey and Governor Scott Walker in your state. I think they've done it in extraordinarily different ways. Neither of them are running for president, obviously, let's stipulate that. But if Governor Christie were, say, a national spokesperson on this issue, I think he makes a very compelling case to people in very common sense terms and tries to sound pretty reasonable about it and has been relatively successful in New Jersey, although I think, you know, lately has run into some more trouble. You know, for Governor Walker, who didn't spend the same amount of time laying the groundwork and holding the town halls and has, I think, been more punitive in a state where the unions were more willing to compromise than they were in New Jersey, that's a significantly harder kind of message to sell nationally because it seems just sort of negative and anti and not doesn't seem to be achieving any more constructive policy agenda. So I think it depends how a Republican goes about making this argument. You know, a guy like Mitch Daniels, should he get into the race, and he has his vulnerabilities too, but, you know, I think he's a guy who makes this case much more like Governor Christie, and I think he would make it as a national candidate, talking about sort of how the country needs to change and its expectations from government, and government workers need to change their expectations. And I could see him making that part of an overall platform about government in Washington. But it's not likely to become the same kind of issue that it is in a New Jersey or Wisconsin, simply because, you know, the federal government doesn't have the same issues, say, with teachers and teachers' unions. That obviously doesn't employ teachers the way that states do.
Right.
And that is really where the flashpoint is for a lot of the public. That's where the selling point is. So I think it's going to be less of an issue, but it might be there.
As you know, longtime and senior Wisconsin Senator Herb Cole announced his retirement last week. Paul Ryan is going to decide in the next couple days whether or not he will run for that seat. Do you think he faces an easy election here because of his national prominence? Who, when you think about pairing him with a strong Democrat in the state, who do you pair him with that would be good for the Democrats to run? Do you think he would be making a wise decision, or would it be a rough race for him?
You're talking about Ryan specifically.
Right.
Yeah. It's a, you know, you've got quite a state going on there.
Yeah, Kathleen. We do. I know.
You got a lot of national influence. You got a lot of, and you got a lot of impressive politicians. I mean, we won't all agree on who they are. They're at odds with each other. But on both sides of the spectrum, you've got people who make themselves heard in a variety of ways. You know, you just have a great tradition out there. I don't know how strong a Senate candidate Paul Ryan would be at this particular moment. I mean, you know better than I do. He's a very personable politician. He has an impressive mind. He's a good communicator. He's obviously put forth a plan here that is very easily used against him.
Mm-hmm.
To the point where his own national party doesn't really want a whole lot to do with it. So, you know, how that plays in the environment of Wisconsin, which of course is a pretty traditionally progressive state, I just don't know. I've heard, you know, rumors, and you probably know more about them than I do, that Russ Feingold could run again.
We have heard that.
You know, there you have no shortage of strong politicians there. I don't know. Has anyone talked about Governor Doyle? Is he coming back? Or
that name has not been mentioned. I haven't heard it. No.
Interesting. You know, and that might be a tough race for him. But I guess my short answer, and I just think you would know better than I do, is I think Paul Ryan has all the political skills to run for higher office, and I wouldn't be surprised to see him do it. But he has, you know, really by taking a very substantive, controversial, intellectual approach to his party's agenda, he has ensured himself that there will be no easy elections. I don't necessarily think that condemns him. I just think it means he's got a tougher road ahead of his own making.
It would be a darn fascinating race, a Ryan Feingold race, wouldn't it?
It'd be tremendous. I mean, and I think the state would. I think it'd be a good campaign, a respectful campaign. I mean, they would disagree strongly, but those are a couple guys with the courage of their convictions and the ability to communicate them. I think it'd be really fun to watch.
We welcome phone calls. Please join us early. We're doing half hour guests. So Matt Bai is with us for the first half hour. Political writer. He's a writer of the Political Times column for the New York Times and chief political correspondent for the Times Magazine, and also has a new column for the Caucus, the Times Politics and Government blog, which is mighty interesting. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. We're talking a good deal of politics because he's written about it a whole lot, and we have major news out of Wisconsin with Cole's retirement. So join us. What do you think about a Ryan Feingold race? That would really be philosophically a fascinating race, don't you think? So join us. Only a few minutes with Matt left. 800-486-8655 is our number. number, 800-486-8655, or send us an email, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program this Monday, Lester Brown joins us, founder and president of Earth Policy Institute, who's written a fascinating and disturbing article about the price of food. We pay less than 10% in this country, but in many developing countries, the cost of food per day is 50 to 70% of a family's income, and it's causing all kinds of land grabs, and dictators are being ousted partially because of this. The 21st century Food Wars with Lester Brown, our number two of our show. Matt Bai is with us now. We start our calls with Mark in Appleton. Hi, Mark.
Hi there. Hold on one second. So I was just calling about Paul Ryan's plan to balance the budget. I mean, it's a little frustrating. It gets so much press, and it's called substantive when it takes 20 years or more to balance the budget and begins by cutting more taxes for the wealthy and pretty much decimating social programs. I mean, turning Medicare into a voucher program is really undercutting and dramatically changing that program, which is why it's so unpopular, because why his program is so unpopular, because it, A, it doesn't balance the budget, and B, really does great harm to social programs that are very popular, that do need to be reformed because they're very expensive, but he's not addressing that.
Matt.
Well, I disagree in the sense that something isn't substantive just because you don't agree with it and think it's destructive. I mean, it is simply the most specific, divisive, really, and sort of candid plan according to sort of Republican philosophy of what should happen in the budget. That's come out of the party, in a party that now runs the House of Representatives and is about to contest a presidential race. So, you know, it is an encapsulation of Republican philosophy in a very specific way, and if it is that unpopular and that divisive and that unworkable, it's going to be rejected. And I think it might well be rejected, and Democrats are certainly confident it'll be rejected. But, you know, it's honest and substantive in the sense that it says, hey, if we really want to get this budget thing under control, we don't like these entitlement programs, they need to be changed, people's expectations need to be changed, and we're going to go ahead and dismantle them and change the formula for the next generation of voters. And I think that's a debate the country absolutely should have, and I give credit for putting it out there on the table and not trying to obfuscate about it. Now, having said that, I would qualify by saying substantive is one thing, courageous is another. And I've heard a lot of people and some of my colleagues say, well, you know, it's so courageous of him to have put this plan out there. I find it a little disappointing in the sense that what I think would have been more courageous is if Congressman Ryan, who was Chairman Ryan, who was part of this fiscal commission, this bipartisan fiscal commission, had adopted more of those recommendations and fought his own party to get those through, as opposed to simply putting out a plan that he knew would resonate with Republican core voters and his colleagues in the caucus, even if they don't embrace it publicly. But that really doesn't have much chance of passing. I think he's made a strong substantive contribution to the debate in terms of actually solving the problems politically. Certainly the most effective path from point A to point B was to draw on what the fiscal commission had already done, and he refused to sign on to that and refused to adopt its programs because I think it would have made him more than anything a pariah inside his own party's circles.
When is the deadline for the debt ceiling, Matt? Is it this week?
Today is the day that we reach the debt ceiling.
Oh, it's today.
Happy Debt Ceiling Day, Kevin.
What's going to happen?
I'm not a fiscal expert, but my understanding is that doesn't mean a whole lot because there's lots of gimmicks and ways in which the government continues to borrow money and function for another couple of months. So we're not until sometime later in the summer are we going to reach crisis point. But today is the marker at which the debt ceiling has effectively been reached.
Huh. Let's go to one more phone call. Myrna in Madison. Hi, Myrna.
Hi there.
Hi.
I'd like to say a couple things, but I'd like to start by saying that I think a Feingold Ryan race would be terrible. And that has nothing to do with my personal politics, although personally I have four Ryan's politics, but I think a race like that is extremely polarized and basically catches people on the extremes and leaves people in the middle with no place to go, really, and that worries me greatly. And as near as I can tell, it's the middle that decides a race. I guess the other comment I wanted to make, and I wish somebody would expound on this for me, is Ryan-type politics, which seems to be the stamp of the Republican Party right now, seem to be all about making it okay to be heartless. I've got mine, you get yours, and the heck with everybody else. And I just don't get it. I just don't get how that became vogue and why that's happened.
Matt.
Myrna, well, you know, first of all, I think, Myrna, you raise a really good point. Now you've got me rethinking. I mean, I do think it would be great to see a Feingold-Ryan race, only in the sense that polarizing on policy is okay. I don't, it wouldn't be, I don't think, uncivil or dishonest or ugly or nasty or expedient. I think these are a couple guys who would make substantive, impassioned cases, and in that sense, I think it would be really interesting. Would it leave voters in the middle nowhere to go? It might. I mean, I think that's a really good point. It might be better for a lot of voters who I know in Wisconsin are pretty pragmatic to have a more pragmatic alternative. I don't know that Russ Feingold as a senator was particularly extreme. He was more of an iconoclast. It was hard to know where he'd land. But I could sympathize with your frustration there, and I think it's a duly noted point. On the in terms of the entitlements programs, I mean, this is a debate we could have for hours and talk about. I can tell you that's not how Republicans see it. You know, it is easy to and listen. It was for years. Democrats use scare tactics on Medicare and Social Security, and then Republicans use those scare tactics to their same advantage in 2010. And now it's turning around again, right? And it's always easy for somebody to say, all you want to do is dismantle. All you want to do is, I've got mine, and I don't care what happens to you. But that's not really, for a lot of people who are serious about this issue, at the heart of the argument. At the heart of the argument that Paul Ryan and others are making is that the programs aren't sustainable, that they were designed for a different period, that they're eating up a huge share of the federal budget, and that, and this is something people don't talk about much, but I'll say it, that even if you could make them sustainable and solvent over the next 30 or 40 years, I think it's worth having a national debate about how much of our investment as a country we want to take from the young and give to the old, because that has to do with the growth and the viability of a country. How much of your wealth are you giving to your oldest citizens? And I think the question then becomes, if you believe that the viability is a real question, then how do you restructure? And it may be that Paul Ryan's plan is far too radical for you and other voters to consider, but it may leave too many people too exposed. I'm not a policy expert. It seems to me that it probably does. But the idea that it's worth debating whether these programs can remain structured as they are and whether some people need to sacrifice more and whether we need to rethink that social contract, I think that's a noble debate that people can have without being accused of not caring about the poor or not caring about the old. Accusing people of not caring just doesn't further the debate. And the fact is, it's not what's driving the concern of a lot of good public servants.
Mm. Well, this time went way too fast. Matt, thank you so much for being with us.
Glad to do it. Thank you, Kathleen.
Matt Bai, writer of the Political Times column for the New York Times, chief political correspondent for the Times Magazine, and he has a new column for the caucus, the Times Politics and Government blog, which is darned interesting. Recent pieces have looked at an extensive piece on Newt Gingrich and what he is thinking, why comparisons of Governor Walker and Governor Christie don't hold up, which is also worth reading, and many more. We just changed guests now for All Things Political. Brett Stevens is joining us now, deputy editor of the editorial page for the Wall Street Journal, where he also writes the Global View column. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Brett, and our number remaining the same. It's 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email address, as always, is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. org for you to join our conversation. And Brett is joining us right now. Hi, Brett.
How are you?
Fine. How are you?
Good. Good to be on the line with Wisconsin.
Yeah, great to have you here. Wisconsin is where it's all happening, Brett.
Well, it was where it was happening a couple months ago, but events have moved on, right?
I don't know. Now we're going to have a Senate race, so I don't think things are going to move on yet. You know, I'm going to pick up on one of the callers we just had for Matt Bai, who said that people get elected in this country if they represent the middle, that the middle in America are the people who maybe feel as though they're not being served right now, that they've got two extremes. What do you think about that? Do we have middle candidates here? Is the middle the way that people should govern, and is it how they get elected?
I guess the answer is middle of what? Middle of Oklahoma is a little different from middle of Wisconsin, which is a little different from the middle of Vermont. Look, there's an obvious virtue in centrist politics because extremes can be frightening. There are obvious drawbacks to centrist politics, not the least of which is it tends to lead to consensus over conviction, and sometimes you need a politics of conviction. It's really a matter of circumstance. I mean, you look at some of the principal kind of centrist politicians of the 18th or 19th century Britain, and no one can remember their names. When you look at politicians who made a difference certainly in the United States, they were conviction politicians who were not quite coming from the middle, whether that's Lincoln or FDR or Ronald Reagan. These were guys who didn't simply represent the center of American politics, and we remember them accordingly.
Mm-hmm. We spent some time talking about Newt Gingrich, who is going to run for president.
Sorry, go ahead. I'm laughing already.
You're laughing about Newt Gingrich? Why?
I think he's not a serious candidate.
Really? Why do you say that?
I'm not quite sure how Newt Gingrich overcomes insuperable obstacles to his candidacy, but you know we'll see. I'll leave it at that. I probably shouldn't have chuckled so much since I'm barred from making political statements by the rules that govern Dow Jones. But so just take that as an instinctive, not thought out response.
Do you think he's a substantive thinker?
A substantive thinker. Newt Gingrich is a man who once said that Alvin Toffler, this kind of nutty futurist from the 1970s, was the person who had the greatest influence on his political thinking. I mean, you could mention the founders, you could mention Hayek, you could mention the Greek philosophers. Alvin Toffler.
Maybe he's changed his mind since then. Well, let me ask you then, who you think are the most substantive thinkers in the Republican Party and in the Democratic Party right now?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. Substantive thinker is a little different from a substantive politician, right?
Mm.
Look, you know, you have at least a few governors. You can guess who they are. Who have some record of successful governance, and who have given some thought to basic issues which confront the U.S. right now, not the least of which is the unstoppable growth of entitlement spending, or the seemingly unstoppable growth of entitlement spending, and the causes of it, and the ways in which it can be. The ways in which it can be seriously addressed. Look, you know, I really write mainly about foreign affairs, and I see things from that angle. I grew up most of my childhood outside of the United States and have spent many of my professional years in Europe and the Middle East. And I would only say that people should not think that what is happening in Greece, or what is happening in Portugal, or other countries that have effectively bankrupted themselves through decades of economic mismanagement, that those examples can't be true to where or indicate where America may be going. We have been an economic powerhouse, the dominant economic power for so many generations now, that perhaps we've lost the generational memory of what it means when your currency, for example, is no longer a credible currency. That's a possibility that we run. We've forgotten, at least there's been at least one generation that since we have any real memory of what rampant inflation looks like. I mean, for me, it's a very distant memory. It's a more vivid memory, I think, for people who were adults through the 1970s. But all of these are real issues. So when I think of what's happening in the United States, I tend to look abroad for examples of what happens after years of governments that are spendthrift and monetary policy that's irresponsible and inflationary.
Let's go abroad and look at, I can remember doing a lot of talk shows that said that the war in Afghanistan could be the undoing of this particular president. Let's look at the morass in which we find ourselves in terms of relations with Pakistan and in terms of what is the step forward in Afghanistan as a result of the capture of Osama bin Laden. Does that change things significantly, his death or not?
Well, as the old saying goes, it's too soon to say, and we may have to wait a very long time until we appreciate just how significant it is. I tend to think that it is. I say so with a bit of humility, for a variety of reasons. The first of which is that Al-Qaeda was in the business of symbolism. It didn't strike the World Trade Center or the Pentagon so much for their value as military targets. It struck them for symbolic value. And bin Laden, in his ability to escape detection, elude capture, became a very potent symbol for a certain brand of radical Islamist militancy. It's not simply that he was killed that matters. It's that he was exposed and living in this rather comfortable house in Abbottabad, a town I've been in, as a matter of fact, rather than out, you know, in the mountains of western Pakistan. It matters that we caught glimpses of the very ordinary pedestrian life that he seemed to lead. He ceased being a figure of myth, and I think that may have an effect on the minds of would-be jihadis, both about the fate that they might expect and about the life that their presumptive leader and exemplar actually followed. There's also the aspect of the fact that at least it seems that bin Laden maintains some genuine operational control over Al-Qaeda's over Al-Qaeda's activities, and that's the fact that he's dead is significant too. But it's much too soon to say just how important it is. There have been cases in which the capture of a major terrorist leader has led to his organization effectively shutting down. You think of the Sendero Luminoso in Peru. And there have been cases where it hasn't made much of a difference. You think of Sheikh Yassin and Hamas in Gaza and the West Bank.
Mm-hmm. And what about in Pakistan? Do you see militancy growing in that country? Or can they be an ally of ours? What are we to do with Pakistan?
Well, Pakistan, I guess, is what Seinfeld would call a frenemy, right?
Right.
Was it Seinfeld who said who?
I have no idea, but it's a good expression.
But I think whoever coined it, I think it's apt. They cooperate with us in some ways. They oppose us in others, and it's sometimes hard to tell when their cooperation is sincere or even when their opposition is sincere. I mean, it's still not entirely clear whether the noises that the Army Chief of Staff of Pakistan, General Kiani, has been making amount to a kind of public temper tantrum offered for domestic political reasons, or whether they're genuine expressions of intent. What do you do with the Pakistanis? Look, this is a serious country. It has over 100 nuclear weapons. It is crucial for the future of South Asia on both of its major frontiers. You might even say all three of its major frontiers, Iran, Afghanistan, and of course, India. It's hard to imagine scenarios where the United States is not worse off by cooperating with it. We ought to try to find areas in which we can maintain that cooperation, but we also ought to make it clear to the Pakistanis that we will reward good behavior and at the same time punish bad behavior. So I hope that President Obama continues to pursue the same policy he has very diligently pursued with respect to drone strikes against major terrorist leaders, and perhaps other kill and capture operations against Zawahiri, Mullah Omar, people like the Haqqani, head of the Haqqani network, all of these guys who are masterminding and spearheading the Taliban's efforts in Afghanistan.
Brett Stevens, our guest, this portion of All Things Political, deputy editor, editorial page of the Wall Street Journal. He writes the journal's Global View column on foreign affairs, which runs every Tuesday in this country and is also published in European and Asian editions of the paper. We start our calls with Matt from Lake Geneva. Hi, Matt.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm going to talk about the political race for the president of the United States again. In looking at the candidates, I want to look for someone who is not a wholly owned subsidiary of the Wall Street interests, somebody who realizes that we can't continue to be the policeman of the world. And I want to look for someone who can make a different kind of coalition of the libertarian elements of the right wing in America, the conservatives, and somebody who can draw the anti-war progressives and progressives who, for instance, might think that our insane war on drugs needs to be changed. And so I'm going to look at the guy that the CNN poll recently said has the best chance to run against Obama of the whole Republican field, and that's going to be Ron Paul.
Brett.
Yeah, well, that's what, as he was speaking, I thought this guy sounds like he's keen on Ron Paul. Good luck. Paul, Paul is a very interesting candidate in that he is someone who, it seems to me, runs on some very strong core convictions. We'll see.
More phone calls in a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Hour number two of our program, Lester Brown joins us of the Earth Policy Institute, and we look at the new geopolitics of food. He says for the planet's poorest 1 billion people, soaring food prices may mean going from two meals a day to one, and he's also written extensively about the huge political problems that can result from food prices being so high for so many people. We go to Tim in Ladysmith is our next caller for Brett Stevens, deputy editor of the editorial page for the Wall Street Journal. Hello, Tim.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Very good show.
Sure.
Going back to a topic you were speaking about earlier, and that had to do with entitlement programs. I'm not entirely sure. I would suggest maybe doing a program on the correlation or the parallels between the Roman Empire's demise and the United States, because it seems like we are following the template of the Roman Empire. I don't know what it's going to take to wake up the American public as well as our politicians to the fact that we are spending our way into oblivion and no one wants to seem to pay the price. We've neglected this for so long, and it's going to be painful because we're going to have to probably cut everything that can be cut. And I'm not sure Americans are ready to swallow that, but your guest made mention of Greece and what happened there, and I can certainly see riots in our streets if entitlements are cut, because that seems to be a project of so many people. So thank you very much.
Thanks for the call, Tim. Brett?
Roman Empire? Well, I mean, there's something to what your caller just said. I would caution, though, against those kinds of historical comparisons. You know, America is frequently compared to an empire, but really, fundamentally, it isn't. I mean, the Romans The problem with the Roman Empire is that they controlled a lot of people who were not themselves Roman citizens, and that proved disastrous for them. It's a similar deal with, for example, the British Empire at the end of the 19th century, beginning of the 20th century, where Indians, were the hundreds of millions of people in the subcontinent, were they British citizens? They were not. Were all of England's colonial possessions in Africa, did they incorporate British citizens? No, they weren't that either. And so that was the real problem that those empires had. The United States is extensive, but it's fundamentally a nation state. There was an issue of cultural and ethnic and religious differences that the Roman Empire simply couldn't manage that aren't really applicable to the U.S. So I get a little I get a little annoyed when I hear the U.S. compared to an empire. Maybe if we were controlling colonies around the world by people who weren't citizens of the United States, it would make a little more sense. But on the question of the results of ruinous economic policy, your caller is right. Riots on the street on a scale much larger than what happened in Madison is one possibility.
What did you think of the Senate hearings last week? The CEOs of the biggest oil companies who were appearing regarding whether or not we should do tax breaks for those people, or some would say that it helps them spur on new discoveries. What did you make of that hearing?
Well, I think it's like a lot of congressional hearings where someone wants, there is a problem, and these guys are the world's most convenient scapegoats, and I think very unfairly scapegoated. Of course, I'm sure some segment of your listeners are going to say I'm a shill for the oil industry. So for the record, I take no money from them and have no particular brief for them. But the oil business is unique in terms of the size of its exploration costs, the political risks they run in drilling for oil throughout the world, the regulatory risks that they run, and also the simple issue that the price of oil is partly a function of supply and demand, and when you have not enough supply and growing demand in a global market, prices are going to rise, and it's partly a function of monetary policy, which is driving up the prices not just of oil, but of many other commodities as well.
Tim, thanks for the call. Joseph in La Crosse, hi.
Hi. First of all, I read your column on a regular basis, good sir. In fact, I had to renew my subscription to the Journal lately. I tried to see if I could do without it, and it was like a drug. I had to have more.
Thank you.
One thing, you actually caused me to change my question. You just mentioned in terms of supply and demand of oil, but that seems a little off kilter, what you just said, to be honest, because we talk about supply and demand as if we needed more oil, but the reality is when countries decide as prices drop that they're going to pump less of it, that's like chip manufacturers saying the chip prices have dropped too low, we're going to stop manufacturing chips now. But in fact, that's not what happened at all, especially during the 80s when we thought we'd lose control of chips and processors and everything else. It went elsewhere. People made lots of them. There was a glut on the market, and then really creative, interesting, talented people came up with ways to use it. And it seems to me that to say that there's a shortage of oil is kind of funny. When we could increase production, Saudi Arabia could increase production, but OPEC consistently holds back production as a result of determinations related to price as opposed to related to demand. So I'm just curious as to your take on that.
I'm not sure I agree that OPEC has the ability to really determine global prices, at least the way they did, say, in 1973 with the famous oil embargo. Bear in mind that one of the greatest drivers in terms of the price of oil is that you have millions and millions of Chinese and Indian citizens who used to drive around on bicycles or on foot suddenly getting into their first economy car. That takes oil. There is only one oil market in the whole world. It's a global market. And so the extraordinary growth of India and China in particular, you're talking about basically 2.5 billion people there, more than a third of the population of the world, suddenly becoming energy consumers has a great deal to do with the rise of oil prices over time. I mean, it doesn't account for short-term fluctuations, which of course take into account political risks. A lot of oil traders are nervous for obvious reasons about what's happening in the Middle East, and it also doesn't take into account the price of the dollar, in which oil is usually denominated. When the dollar is essentially a weaker currency, you're going to see a rise in prices. But I would say those two factors are major drivers in explaining why oil, at least in my neighborhood, is well over $4 a gallon. Oh.
Thanks very much for the call. This hour's gone too fast. Brett, thank you so much for being with us. Appreciate your time today.
It's a pleasure. My regards to Wisconsin.
Yeah, okay.
Okay, go Badgers.
Brett Stevens, deputy editor, editorial page of the Wall Street Journal. He writes their Global View column on foreign affairs, which you can see tomorrow. He's also deputy editorial page editor responsible for the pages of the Asian and European editions of the paper, the columnists on foreign affairs, and the Far Eastern Economic Review. He also worked as an editorial writer in Brussels for the Wall Street Journal Europe. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this very interesting hour, and thanks to Rhonda Fanning for on-air production here in our downtown Milwaukee studios. We have news coming up from National Public Radio. For all of you who love politics, we'll be speaking on Thursday of this week with the author of A Singular Woman, The Untold Story of Barack Obama's Mother by Jannie Scott, which is really a great read, so that's one show you may want to make note of.